So now you'll have Dr. Ruben Goya talking about Palestine, Israel, the Middle East in the context of foreign policy and kind of the political science analysis of what's going on there, politics. If you guys have any questions, I know some of you have been to a few of these before, but he will probably give a short lecture, and then we'll open it up to questions, kind of the same format as always. Expect it to last about an hour.
I know this is a chapel, so all you backbenchers can move to the front. But thank you for inviting me. I want to begin by noting that maybe I should begin with a disclaimer. I am not an expert on the Middle East. I'm a political science expert or a historian for that reason. And so what I'm charged to do this evening is to at least shed some light on America's foreign policy with respect to the Middle East and kind of give a general framework of analysis, maybe a framework that might enable us to understand a little better what is going on. Is it possible to close the door?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a guillotine back there for the latecomers? Some of my students know where that is coming from. But so again, thank you very much. I'm not sure it's that cold, so do you think it's that cold?
Mm-hmm.
No. But I appreciate your being here this evening. I want to do three things. Just to give a very brief history of this conflict in the Middle East, or at least the situation in the Middle East. Some of you who have attended previous talks will have had some kind of historical context to this from Dr. Willingham and others. But I can't talk about foreign policy without talking about history, and at least giving a general outline of the history of the issue. Then I want to talk a little bit about the theoretical framework that we often use in analyzing foreign policy, but more importantly in explaining international politics. I will then go on to attend to my third task, which will be outlining the drivers of American foreign policy towards the Middle East. And in outlining these drivers, I will give you a sense of my basic thesis, which will then be the point of departure for the specific issues that we want to have a discussion about tonight. The history is rather brief. If we start with the history of the founding of the Jewish state, we begin perhaps from the events preceding the founding of the Jewish state in 1948. The most important event, of course, is the Second World War, preceded by the Holocaust. This is important for several reasons. The Holocaust itself would become an important part of the founding of the Jewish state because the international community felt, if not guilty, at least obligated to create a state that would become the homeland, if you will, of a people who lived in a diaspora, but more importantly, of a people who had been victimized brutally by the Nazis and in the Holocaust. This, of course, was also triggered, or I would say catalyzed, promoted, lubricated by nationalism, otherwise expressing itself in the form of Zionism. The role of the United Nations then became very important in the final establishment of the State of Israel, that the British government would play a key role in carving out a state out of the Palestinian land, so to speak. So what we have happening then is the Balfour Declaration, which is really the beginning during which the British government begins to change the narrative of the region, of the politics, and of the history. And from there, we see the steady formation of the Jewish state. What is really interesting about the Balfour Declaration is that within the declaration itself, the British government, or the RASTA, is saying, look, we do not want a Jewish state that would violate the interests of the natives, in other words, the Palestinians. But of course, this was not to be, because you don't form a state without displacing people. But nonetheless, the eventual founding of the state was to be established in 1948. That story in and of itself is very, very long. So I'll stop the story there for purposes of tonight's discussion. We can then talk about the struggles for a Palestinian state. The struggles for a Palestinian state also begin and are part of the narrative of British colonial rule. That is why Britain was a pivotal player or actor in the formation of the Jewish state. Well, the British were a colonial power in the region. The formation of and the boundaries of the region were to be drawn out according to the interests of the British as they saw fit, and especially as they began to withdraw from the region. British acquiescence in the founding of the Jewish state was very much a part of the fate of the Palestinians. So if you read the history, you'll find an entity called the Transjordan, out of which we'll see and we find at some point the creation of the Palestinian state. The Palestinian resistance to the emergence of the Jewish state is itself rooted in Arab nationalism. So as much as we see the manifestation of Jewish nationalism in the form of Zionism, we do see the manifestation of Arab nationalism, perhaps initially as, or in the form of Pan-Arabism. Because as we see later, Arab states kind of come into some kind of coalition in order to resist on behalf of their Palestinian brothers, the formation of a Jewish state, which ultimately leads to the exile of thousands of Palestinians into Jordan and Syria and other parts of the Middle East and Egypt. This resistance resulted in a number of wars, such as the 1967 war and others, which continue to expand the geographic identity of Israel and further marginalize the Arabs in the area, in the regions in which this expansion would take place. The formation of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, I believe in 1974, then was intended to kind of sharpen the search and the struggle for a Palestinian state. The Palestinian Liberation Authority, which is now what we know as the governing entity in the West Bank, which is, of course, occupied by Israel, technically, is part of this whole process of the Palestinian Liberation Authority. Again, the role of the United Nations has been pivotal, albeit not with as much emphasis and not with as much impact as was the case for the formation of the Israeli state. The third major actor, of course, is the role of the United States. And so we're going to be talking about the United States as an actor, as an important actor, not only in the context of the United Nations, as a member of the Security Council, as the most powerful member, perhaps, of the Security Council of the UN, but also the United States as a sovereign superpower acting in pursuit of its own interests. Hence the significance of trying to analyze the foreign policy of the United States and its pivotal and significance in shaping the politics of the region. That really is simply the tip of the iceberg in terms of the history and the politics of the region. But for purposes of our discussion tonight, as I mentioned earlier, I'll put that aside and talk a little bit about the theoretical framework that would that would help us to understand the U.S. foreign policy, and perhaps the foreign policy of most countries. I'm going to briefly outline three basic approaches to our study of international politics theoretically. I'll begin with the realist approach, and along the way here I'll try to intersperse it with Israel and Palestine. But the realist approach is one, when used by political scientists, interprets the international system as dominated by fear. This fear of each sovereign state in the international system creates the need for force as the major thrust in dealing with other countries. The international system is also understood by the realists as operating on the basis of a zero-sum game, meaning that to the extent that each state is fearful of the other, and each state is pursuing the interests of its own at the expense of the other, which is what I mean by a zero-sum game, it makes for a rather anarchic international system. So realists in general say, look, fear is the key motivating factor in human nature. States are erected in order to ensure their safety. Force must be used, and more importantly, power must be accumulated in order for it to be used to ensure and guarantee the security of each sovereign state. The liberal approach to international politics looks at the international system and sees the international system as comprised of competition. Sovereign states competing one against the other, but able to cooperate in this process of competition. So for liberals, the game that is played is a positive-sum game. States can compete, albeit cooperatively, and subsequent to that, we can then operate through, let's say, international organizations or intergovernmental organizations. So for instance, while liberals believe that the cooperation can take place and the competition can take place within international bodies where states can come together and discuss matters of mutual interest and limit acrimony and perhaps de-emphasize the possibility of conflict and war, realists believe that each state should only pursue its own national interests, its own national security interests, and only secondarily consider the possibility of joining international organizations. The thrust from a realist perspective is each state is on its own. The third approach is the idealist approach, which is fairly new in the study of international politics and believes that the international system should really be governed by very basic ideas. Ideas of what we have, ideas of our mutual interests, shared ideas. And these shared ideas can enable us to make change, which change can be stable, profitable, and free of acrimony. So those are the theoretical frameworks that we generally use in the study of international politics, and more importantly, in analyzing U.S. Foreign policy in general. We're going to focus on U.S. foreign policy in particular. What then are the drivers of American foreign policy towards the Middle East, if not towards the world in general? And I'll put forth here what I consider to be my thesis tonight, which is that American foreign policy towards the Middle East, and by extension towards much of the world, is driven by fear, rather than the courage or conviction of its ideals and promise. Which means, therefore, that American foreign policy is to be placed within the realist theoretical approach, within the theoretical, rather the realist perspective. What do I mean by this? What do I mean when I say that American foreign policy toward the Middle East, and by extension, much of the world, is driven by fear rather than courage or conviction of its ideals and promise? articulate this, I'm going to share with you two examples. One, which is going to illustrate the few times that the United States has operated not from a position of fear, but rather from a position of courage and conviction of its ideals and promise. And I'm going to talk very briefly about the 1994 intervention in Bosnia, for example. You will recall that during this crisis, many in the United States were saying the United States really does not have any vested interest, any national security interest that would precipitate and even necessitate the deployment of American troops, even within the context of NATO. However, the articulation by the Clinton administration back then as to why the United States should intervene was simply this, that ethnic cleansing was contrary to the basic American ideals, the human rights ideals and democratic basic beliefs of the United States, and on the basis of that, the United States was legitimized in its intervention. The United States, as we know, went ahead and intervened under the umbrella of NATO and some kind of new order, a new dispensation was set. In operating through fear, however, I'm going to use the example that has brought us all here tonight, which is, in what ways can we trace this drive from the perspective of fear in the Middle East that is devoid, in my view, of courage and the ideals and promise of the United States. By the way, if I may digress just for a moment, when I talk about the ideals and promise of the United States, what exactly do I mean? I am referring to the idea that this is a country that is founded on the notion of independence, of self-determination, of liberty, of freedom, and of the promise of human rights, and that in fact the country is not simply a geographic political entity, but in fact a conglomeration or a collectivity of ideas, that America in fact is an idea in and of itself, rooted in the values that I just mentioned. And so what I'm suggesting here tonight is that the U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, and I would argue for much of what goes on in the world, is not, and not always, and unfortunately rarely rooted in these ideals, but rather triggered by this notion of fear. What then is it that is causing fear in the Middle East, and particularly with respect to Israel and the Palestine? There is a rooted fear in the United States of Islam. So the words that are often used today, popularized by the press, and adopted by policymakers when the word Islam is mentioned, are what? You can help me actually answer these questions. What are the words that we associate? Terrorism? Extremism? I'm sorry? Jihadists? Islamists? Violence? And in moralistic terms, we often associate this word with evil. That is the moral underpinning of this. So there's a fear. And it is this fear then, rather Islam then, begins to become the undercurrent, the underpinning to the construction of policy towards the Middle East. We can contrast this to what we associate with Judaism. What words might we associate with Judaism?
Holocaust.
The Holocaust? Well, what does the word Holocaust in fact conjure up in our minds?
Genocide.
Genocide, suffering.
Victimhood.
Victimization. And since these are the images that are conjured in our minds, the policy reflects these very notions. Someone mentioned terrorism. There is a fear of terrorism. And I'm suggesting here that this terrorism would then drive foreign policy in a way. The fear of terrorism would drive the United States foreign policy with respect to certain areas, certain regions in the world, certain peoples in the world. So we have, in the case of terrorism, a confluence of Islam on the one hand and Arab on the other. So ethnicity and religion find a nexus out of which grows a foreign policy set of responses. So if we mention terrorism, of course it has to be gotten rid of. We have to deploy our forces if necessary. The language we use is going to essentially be one that is laced with very heavy, stigmatized forms of discourse. And when the language engenders these kinds of images, the policy that flows out of it is going to equally be one that may not necessarily be shaped to address the specific challenges, but rather the perceptions we have of those challenges. We are also afraid, I think, in the United States, of very high oil prices. So following Iran's declaration yesterday, or was it today, that Iran would not be selling oil to Britain or France, the uncertainty that that creates sends oil prices through the roof. And what would journalists do? Every editor, every producer of a news program now is sending a reporter to a gas station nearby to have the camera pointed on the pump and the marquee that shows how much the gas prices are. And we, as Americans, whose our identity is rooted in the automobile, freedom, automobile, a car is freedom. We equate those two. A car is freedom. A train is not freedom. Have you thought about this? In the United States, when you talk about a car, we're talking about freedom. When we talk about a gas guzzler, we are talking about more than adrenaline. We are talking about something even bigger than that. I'm looking for a word to describe this. Testosterone. So think about this now. We're talking about the ideals of the United States. They're rooted in the automobile. This notion of independence, where you get in your car, your own car, not carpooling. Carpooling? What? Your own car. You have to be in your own car, and that way you can play your own music. That way you can sit in your own litter. Some of these cars are really... No. But it's mine. So it's my trash, it's my car, it's my music. This is what we associate with this notion of freedom. So the fear of gas going up then enters into the process of policy making. We are afraid of insecurity on the part of Israel. And the reason this is important is because Israel is the country that we associate with the most, and more importantly, it will allow us to balance the power in the region. This balance of power concept is very much part of the realist idea of foreign policy making. So, in essence, we have these fears that then go into the formation of foreign policy towards Israel and towards the Palestinians. Let us look at some policy prerogatives here for the United States. The idea that if a Palestinian state is born, it might endanger the security of Israel. and therefore bring the balance of power in disequilibrium, endangering our security, destabilizing the region, sending oil prices up, and perhaps becoming a cradle within which terrorism might rear its ugly head. Why, in fact, are these not or should not be feared is the question that we'll be answering in a moment. So before we go there, I just want to look at the advantages that the United States has in this context, because then we can talk about the foreign policy initiatives themselves. The United States is still the most powerful military force in the world. It still commands the strongest and biggest economy in the world, and both of those equate to a certain level of political power. These various dimensions of power are brought to bear in the United States as it operates abroad. And it is the idea of operating out of fear that alters this narrative of the Middle East and often radicalizes otherwise benign groups. When you have a chance, please take a look at The Latest Economist from this week, which has a long essay explaining the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. I'll use this as a case study to illustrate the notion of fear. When Egypt's Mubarak was removed from power, the basic question in the United States was, oh my God, what do we do now that our ally Mubarak is out and the Muslim Brotherhood is likely to take over? What are we going to do? If you ask the average American, do you want the Muslim? Do you want the what Brotherhood? The what Brotherhood? Okay, this is the time for us to interact. I'm really not good at just talking to you like that. I really do want us to have a dialogue here. Do you want the what Brotherhood to take over in Egypt? As soon as that is mentioned, what else comes up? And this part of the room.
Suppression of women's rights.
All of these things come up. Ladies and gentlemen, if you read carefully, the Muslim Brotherhood is a nationalist Muslim organization. It is more enlightened than we know. It is much more institutionalized in the way it governs. Everywhere in the Middle East where there's a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, there is much more moderation than you would expect in any other part of the Middle East. This is completely new and completely unknown to the average American citizen and therefore to those who are in power. So I read this with a lot of interest and looked at the Muslim Brotherhood in various countries, in Egypt, in Jordan, in Syria, in Bahrain. If you look at the Muslim Brotherhood, it's not what we think it is. But the fear is there, and it drives foreign policy. What is the other source of American power, other than military, economic, and political? The second source of American power is the multiple fissures, cleavages, and fault lines that divide the Arab world. And so if you look at the various fault lines, whether you're talking about Shia or Sunni or Wahhabi or whatever, these divide the Arab world. If you look at the various countries, it divides the Arab world. So this gives the United States a lot of power. With that power and absent fear, actually there could be a very interesting political process that brings about a foreign policy that is more rooted in reality than the perceptions that we have. So in the making of foreign policy, therefore, what we have found is the case is this notion that, look, as long as we're operating from this perspective of fear, it's going to be very difficult to have policy that in fact reflects the realities in the Middle East, etc. We have this concept in international politics that some of you have been introduced to by no other than yours truly, which is the concept of intermesticity, that domestic and foreign issues combine to create a framework within which foreign policy can be understood. One important aspect, it seems to me, of foreign policy towards the Middle East in the United States, as we were discussing the other morning, is when are we going to begin talking about the demand side of oil instead of constantly talking about the supply side of oil? That could completely change American foreign policy abroad. If we only said, you know what, we're going to talk about demand. Where is demand? Well, demand can be simply and seriously and drastically cut if we only decided that we're going to have a very efficient public transportation system. So as we were discussing the other day in the morning, supposing there was an express train, fast train, from Roanoke to Washington, D.C. It would take a shorter time for us to get to Washington. We would be on our laptop writing our papers on our way to Washington. So we'd be more productive, right? We would pollute less. The demand for oil would go down. The number of Americans who are dying abroad in the name of oil would also decline, and our foreign policy towards the Middle East would change drastically. But the debate in the United States, the discourse in the United States, is about supply. Where can we get more oil? Where can we get more oil is the question, not how can we consume less. Because to talk about consuming less and to talk about the hybrid automobile is not to be American. You must be, something is wrong with you. Why are you driving a hybrid automobile? Why? What's wrong? This is the question. I've had the opportunity to visit Europe for a number of, for some time now, all the way from Sweden to Denmark to France to Belgium, and I'm amazed at how much they've cut back in terms of their demand simply by having a very efficient transportation system. But it all begins with the way we think. It's a state of mind. And so the debate that is going on in this country is that if you talk about an efficient transportation system, you are a socialist. You are a socialist. You want to bring about these European-type socialist countries, or rather ideas. Drill, baby, drill. This is how we're thinking about these things. And so we constantly project this on Iran is a horrible country. Well, let them keep their oil. If we don't buy their oil, what will they do with it? But this is part of what we're talking about in terms of foreign policy. So if we get back into Palestine and Israel, this equation about foreign policy has something to do with the perceptions we have and this question of committing ourselves to a foreign policy that is rooted in fear instead of a foreign policy that is based on the courage and conviction of the ideals of this country, which are ideals of independence. This country went through a revolution. One of the cries of this revolution was that give me liberty or give me... So why is it that the liberty of the Palestinians seems to be incomprehensible to us, or for that matter, indigestible? A foreign policy of courage would suggest this, and I would argue that the independence of Palestine would guarantee and strengthen the security of Israel, not the other way around. Not the other way around. But who is courageous enough to make this argument and to also compute it into foreign policy? The balance of power in the region is a fear. We want the region to have this balance of power. Israel's security is important. If this is a fear, how can we think of a foreign policy that in fact might guarantee this question of, that might continue to balance power in the region? Not every Arab country is an enemy of the United States. Would Palestine, would the state of Palestine actually become an enemy of the United States? If, in fact, the United States becomes the conduit through which a two-state solution is found, I would argue not. After all, there are Arab states in the region that are friendly to us as well. The dialogue then between Washington and Tel Aviv, and notice, by the way, I say Tel Aviv because there are those in the United States circles who say it should be between Washington and Jerusalem. And that's another story that we haven't covered yet. This is kind of like peeling an onion. But this relationship between the two would be altered quite a bit, and altered in ways that are productive for both countries. Let me end with this note, because I know you're dying to ask questions and for us to get into the discussion. If you met an ordinary Iranian or Iraqi or Palestinian, and you started having a discussion with them, the subjects that you'd discuss would range from the following: the kind of music you like, the kind of food you like, your children, your parents, your dreams for your children, dreams for the future. It is surprising how when you meet these people, you actually talk about human issues. You don't talk about war. They don't talk about terrorism. They don't talk about bombs. They don't talk about terrorism. They talk about ordinary human endeavors. But I want to suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that it has become clear in both this world and the other world that when someone says they are to us that they are an Arab and a Muslim, our first temptation is to send a text message, either to the FBI or to our parents or to our lawyer who writes our will, to say, listen, if you don't see me again, please give my iPod to my little brother Jim, because I'm sitting next to someone from Syria. Now, let me change the equation. I must propose also and suggest that in the Middle East, there are quarters in the Middle East that when you say you are an American, they too conjure up certain notions, certain ideals. And yet, at a very human level, we are really talking about human beings wishing to be safe, wishing to be educated, wishing for their children to have a good future, wishing for, okay, nice cars to drive, and easy modes of transportation. What we haven't been able to do is kind of bring our discourse to this level. And so in moralistic terms, we're thinking about this. You're what? You're an American? If you go out there are certain quarters, of course, in Egypt, in Libya, in Bahrain or in Yemen, where they say you're an American? Okay, great. There's a little hole I want to push you into. Are you a CIA agent? FBI? You wouldn't tell me, would you? This is the argument that goes on. Was your father, was your grandfather one of those who bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Did you really do those things to those people in Abu Ghraib? Really? But you always claim that you are Democrats, and that you are liberal, and that you are the beacon of human rights, the leader of the free world, and you always end your speeches with God bless America. Are there other countries in the world that God should bless? This is, I'm painting a picture that brings us here tonight. And I'm suggesting that it is on both ends of the continuum. The significance of your being here tonight is the following: that you begin to construct a new framework to understand the other world, and hopefully, by the time your grandchildren are born, we are not talking about the same basic issues as we're talking about tonight.
Thank you.
the media give us what we enjoy to read? Or is the media a reflection of our values and
You're fine.
Oh, good.
Which is which? Is the media a reflection of our own values? Or do we wish to feed on certain items? Let's bring this down to Roanoke College, right? When we go into the Colquitt to eat, who determines the menu? Do they cook what we really enjoy eating? Or is it the other way around? When I first joined Roanoke College, there was no pizza in there. Why is it there now? I'm sorry? There's probably a vote on it. If you don't eat certain foods, the school is not going to buy those foods, right? It's a waste of money. So what do you want to eat? Chicken tenders? Yeah. So let's go back to the question of the media then. The media is going to produce, the media is both a product of the political culture of the United States, and it is also a product of what we demand to read. But the media too has its own interests. So if the media is operating in a capitalist system and it needs to make profits, that it needs to sell papers, and it sells papers by giving a headline that is going to be rather fearful, a headline that is going to say, whoa, I need to buy this paper and figure out what I'm going to do. So it's a really tricky question as to where one begins to correct that. I don't know the answer to that question. Because to get the answer to that question, I'd want to know what the media is like in other parts of the world. For example, what does the media in Saudi Arabia, or in Bahrain, or in Yemen, or in Libya, what does it actually give to its people? What are the headlines? What is sold there? I might add as well that perhaps we could start from the perspective of what is the leadership saying in terms of, you see, there are several actors that can shape the narrative. We as citizens, policy makers, editorial board chairpersons, and so at some point it's a vicious cycle, and one that is difficult to break. The fear that I talk about that drives American foreign policy is not just on the part of leaders. It obviously has kind of percolated into our own, among the population, among the citizens. And so the question then is, how do we stop it? I think I've raised more questions than I've given answers. But that's part of what academic discourse is about. Yes?
The Obama administration, at least domestically, is a lot more liberal than the previous administration. Mm-hmm. Why haven't we been seeing increased pressure from them on behalf of Israel? Like, why aren't we using our power to enact change in the region?
Okay. Well, that's very good. That goes toward perhaps talking about the story of the American electoral system and how one wins power in the United States. The United States, by virtue of its founding, is a pluralistic society. And by that I mean it is made up of very many interest groups. There are as many interest groups in the United States as perhaps there are students in this college and more. Each one of them has very specific interests. How an item rises on the agenda of the foreign policy process depends on which groups are most powerful, both politically, I would say financially, and then politically, because that's how they influence the electoral system. So at some point, I'm sure in his talks, one has talked about AIPAC, that this is perhaps the most powerful interest group in the United States, the group that lobbies for Israeli interests, Jewish interests. You cannot govern effectively, or be elected, or be re-elected without paying some kind of homage, and that's an understatement, to AIPAC as an interest group. So at some point when the Obama administration was beginning to show some degree of courage in pushing the Palestinian question in a direction that would, in my argument tonight, lead the United States to its ideals, somebody or some people from AIPAC must have said, we need to get rid of this move. And so, in the voting that took place in the Security Council about 3 weeks ago, the United States representative, the permanent representative to the United Nations, Susan Rice, I believe, voted against the resolution that would favor Israel, or rather Palestine, and that the government in Tel Aviv didn't favor. Now we are in an electoral year, or an election year, general election year, as we begin to see the mounting pressure that is exerted in the process of electing a new president or re-electing the incumbent. And it would behoove anybody to act in ways that would fundamentally alter the relationship between Washington and Tel Aviv. The administration has sent an official to Tel Aviv to say, don't attack Iran, and so on, and so on, to kind of smoothen the conflict there. But this is very, very, very important, that the interest groups that are most powerful usually get the access to the table, they define the agenda, and ultimately the direction of policy. Could there be a situation where, let's say, a leader would say, okay, this is my last term, I'm therefore going to act bravely. I'm not interested in being re-elected. That too can be problematic, because at some point, party members will say, we know you don't want to be re-elected, or we know you're serving your second term, but what you are doing seriously undermines any possibility of the party you are representing to gain power, or to gain power and use it effectively in the future. So you cannot do that. So part of what I haven't talked about here is how this contest, this contestation of values, of interests, begin to shape American political, or rather American foreign policy. The only other aspect of it, again, I insist that when we have a discussion of this nature, you all have shown courage. Do you know what you could be doing tonight instead of being here? Yeah, study. but you decided to come here because this is the only way we can begin to change the puzzle, the order, the dispensation, and the priorities within which or by which policy is made. That to the extent that the American people begin to think differently, and to the extent that opinion polls begin to show a different view concerning this conflict, then we begin to see a change. So I've talked about AIPAC. I have not yet talked about the role of, let's say, some very powerful churches in the United States, with the evangelical churches being perhaps on the forefront of this. I mean, if you visit, as I have, a number of evangelical churches, you'll find that there are always contributions asked for that would go towards the support of the Jewish state. Now, you might argue, how strong is the Arab lobby in the United States? And the question is, not very strong. And there are reasons. The reasons, as I just explained, because when you mention that, it's scary. It conjures up these images that make it very difficult for more and more people to coalesce around this particular interest and then force a change in direction in terms of policy. But something is interesting in this country, which is that the fastest growing religion in this country is Islam. Now, when I first came to the United States, I realized that the brand of Islam that most Muslims in the United States advocate is quite different from what I know especially within Black America. It's quite interesting to see how it all works. But nonetheless, I wonder whether the expansion of this particular demographic might begin to change the dynamic of policy and interests, etc. Yes, sir. If we take it technically from the position of international law, there is no room to legitimize the violation of the sovereign integrity or the integrity of a sovereign nation. Now, that can be changed if the Security Council, let's say, issues a resolution that says, yes, we are authorizing action to remove, let's say, Mubarak or Libya's Gaddafi, etc. But in international legal circles around the world today, even that is questioned. To the extent that the Security Council is a club of a few powerful countries, that in fact the Security Council does not in and of itself reflect the majority, not even close to half of the majority of the members of the UN. It's always a question of how legitimate are those resolutions that come out of the Security Council. Now, having put that aside, the question then becomes, okay, if there is a legitimate reason to intervene on behalf of, as we saw in Bosnia, on behalf of a wanton, brutal extermination of a people, whether genocide-like or in a tyrannical, non-systematic way, should there be intervention, does the international community have an obligation, legal or moral, to intervene? Obviously, the answer to that question is yes. But I think the key point to your question is, how come the intervention happens in some countries and not others? Right? So why has there not been intervention in Syria and there was intervention in Libya?
No oil.
Is it oil? Is it what might happen? Does Syria fit into a certain context within the neighboring region that might prevent that? And then you can go into history. You find that there was no intervention in Uganda when the Idi Amin dictatorship was slaughtering people, and yet there was intervention in Chile to remove a socialist leader, to install an authoritarian tyrant, and to allow him to kill and disappear as many people as were disappeared in that country back then. So if we come back to my theoretical framework, the realist approach is talking about this question of national interests. When are the national interests of the United States as a superpower or Britain as a powerful country violated? And when they are violated, those countries will intervene with or without a national, a Security Council resolution. Even then, the intervention is often one that is rooted in fear. In the case of Chile, the fear was that a socialist leader in Chile, no matter how democratic, a socialist leader in Chile would open up the hemisphere to Soviet aggression. Therefore, it was argued in Washington that it was better to have an authoritarian tyrant with perhaps one of the worst human rights violations in the world than have a socialist government that was more democratic. I know, I see the expression on your face, but that is the reality of it. And so the realist approach, therefore, has this notion that, look, the national security interests are the key. But in the end, we lose more than we gain in this process.
What about South Africa?
South Africa.
That was a popular sort of uprising within this country to change the policy.
Yes.
Sort of the anachronistic, you know, exception.
Right. Now, thank you for bringing that argument, that point, Cynthia, because we were talking earlier in response to your question, Angela, and we're saying, how do the American people, as a people, bring about change in foreign policy? The South African case is a classic case study of how the American people as citizens can mobilize over time to completely change the direction of the foreign policy of this country. Because in the case of South Africa, what actually happened is that there were a number of interests and a number of interest groups that coalesced and argued the case of South Africa as one that was completely contrary to the ideals of the United States, to human rights, to liberty, to freedom, and kept moving through the Congress and ultimately to the executive branch and ultimately bringing the South African government to its knees. It took quite a bit of time and it went through several administrations. But it is a classic study of how, in a democracy, you, the citizens, can begin to change the way we think about a specific set of issues and questions, how we mobilize to bring about change, and how at the end of the day we bring about that change and celebrate the very ideals upon which the country is founded. So this was a classic case, because and those of you who are interested might want to go to the PBS documentary that kind of chronicles and gives the narrative of how, from the Rainbow Coalition and other organizations, the American people were able to enter into the Congress and begin to completely alter, slowly, albeit very slowly. It's kind of like someone who is in charge of a huge ship. This is, we call it a ship of state, if we think about the United States and its government. And you can only change the ship gradually. But if there is sufficient momentum within the unpopular will, the government can and does change. And that's what a democracy is all about. But alas, what often happens in the United States is we claim that we have rights, that we have freedoms, but we never utilize them. We never put them into action. Least of all, to go out and vote. Just to vote. I mean, the percentage of America, of Americans who vote, those who are eligible to vote, who actually go to the polls, is very low. So then the idea of saying we have rights and we have freedoms, most of which we don't utilize, is as if it's as the same as not having them. But when and if we bring them to work, they work very well. Some of you are too young, and so am I. But once upon a time, we had a Senator McCarthy. And you see, this was an interesting period in the United States. I was not here, but from what I've read, there was all of a sudden this witch hunt that went on in the United States. And what was the fundamental fear back then?
Communism.
And Senator McCarthy said there are people in the government who are agents of the communists. And so the witch hunt went on and people were purged from very well-meaning, qualified, hard-working, patriotic Americans who were spat out of the system because of this. At some point, there was a push back by the American people within the government that finally got the senator out of office. And I was reading a piece just very recently that Senator McCarthy would later on die as a lonely drunk, was the word that was the description that was used. So the moral of the story is that each and every individual here has the power to change the system. That's what the democracy is all about. You don't live in Saudi Arabia, where power is very much concentrated in the royal family and in the government. But in a democracy, you have to utilize that power. Then the headlines in our newspapers might begin to change. In the case of South Africa, the headlines started changing. Why? Because the administration had already said, you know, we can't do this to South Africa. If we isolate South Africa, if we boycott South Africa, if we slap sanctions on South Africa, then the average black South African will suffer more. So we can't do this, argued the Reagan administration. But more was brought to bear. Pressure was brought to bear by ordinary people. The headlines in the papers began to change. So it's interesting that in the South African case, we can begin to talk about how headlines can change. We can begin to talk about questions of how the power and the mandate of the people begins to exert itself in the way that the government works. Finally, you think, oh, it's just one mind, one vote. Well, certainly that is the case. But you can say, you know, we're going to have a party at Mr. Spangler's house, and I'm inviting about 20 people, come to the party, and we'll have a discussion. So you can A, drink, B, be inebriated, and C, meet a very important political motive, i.e. begin to change the dispensation of American foreign policy. You can do all these things. And by the way, you change the American policy and the American political culture by lubricating it, not with oil, but maybe with a few Budweiser. I'm not advocating alcoholism, but I'm just saying that I know how you college kids meet and what brings people together. I mean, supposing you said we're having a party and we're going to serve cupcakes, come and we talk about Palestine. You might get a few people who like pastries. But if there's a party, we can actually do business. And believe it or not, most diplomats never enter into discussions of this nature without some whiskey and some gin and tonic. So this is not new. It works. I know it works. I've tried it.
Somebody just asked you to leave the country. Oh, I'm not. And that's how they operate. It's very much the story. And we do it with South Africa.
Well attended, but the quality of the teachers here really.